This is Live and Local. I'm your host, Kevin Kelly. We're on every weekday from 12 to 1. And on the program today, we have a representative of the Artemis Quartet, a string quartet which will be performing at the Krannert Center in Urbana tonight at 7:30. He is cellist Eckhart Runge, and it's an all Beethoven program. And then in the later part of the show, folk singer and songwriter, Bill Staines, who will be performing at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center Saturday night at 8 o'clock. That's in downtown Urbana in the old post office building where the IMC has been for, a while now. Not sure how many years it's been already. We'll talk with Bill Staines and hear several of his songs on the show today. Here first, the Artemis Quartet. This is from one of their discs of the complete Beethoven quartets, which they are taking on tour. This is the minuet from Beethoven's Opus 18, number 4 in C minor. Program's Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and my guest for this portion of the show is Eckhart Runge, who is the cellist for the Artemis Quartet, string quartet, who are going to be at the Krannert Center in Urbana Wednesday at 7:30 in the evening in the Follinger Great Hall. They're playing an all Beethoven program, and I thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be there.
You're on a tour of the United States exclusively at the moment, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, we have 13 concerts in 17 days.
And how do you manage to maintain your composure through all of that?
Well, I guess it's basically the enthusiasm for doing what we do. We maintain our, what did you say, composure?
Yeah, I said composure. Yeah.
till the last concert, and then we go back home to collapse and rest for a week.
Yeah, and it's all Beethoven throughout the tour?
Yeah, it's all Beethoven. We're doing this, and next season we're doing the complete Beethoven cycle, which is really exciting to do.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question. In fact, I'm going to sort of introduce it by talking about something else here. This is a quote from a review from the Telegraph in London, which is on your website, says the Artemis Quartet are often asked why, with the whole vast string quartet repertoire at their feet, they want to play tango music by Astor Piazzolla, referring to another project, which I want to ask you about. But I guess I would turn the question around a little bit, and why, with so many quartets available, do you still play so much Beethoven? I mean, asking a German performer that question maybe is sacrilege, but
actually, to be really honest, it's a question we've asked ourselves before we did the Beethoven cycle too. I personally also had a feeling that it might be somewhat, I wouldn't say boring, but let's say after a certain time we would miss playing Bartok or other pieces.
But I'm thinking for the audiences, too. I mean, I'm sure many audiences clamor for Beethoven, but at the same time, I think the last number of quartets that we've had come through the Krannert Center have mostly played Beethoven.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, now that we've been doing this for more than half a season, I must say that our hunger for Beethoven is not yet at all satisfied, and this music is just such a essence of everything. It's like a cosmos of all human emotions, and for me it's probably the greatest there is. So there's enough to really indulge in to for a long time. And the other thing which is totally fascinating is by playing all Beethoven quartets, it gives a totally different picture on every single piece. So usually we, or most string quartets, just get to play one or two Beethovens per season and have a very partial look at the work of this composer. And by playing all of the Beethoven quartets, we felt incredible proximity to the nature of Beethoven is possible by all sorts of links between the pieces that you usually don't see. So for us, it's an emotionally extremely intense experience to do this, and we're far away from missing anything else right now.
And I gather from the fact that you have this wonderful honor of membership in the what is it called? The Verein des Beethovenhauses Bonn, which means, what does that mean in the realm of Beethoven interpreters? Your quartet has this honorary membership in there.
Oh, of course, it is really a huge honor. And apart from that, it is also practically very exciting because we get to we can look at the handwritings. I mean anyone could look at the handwriting because they have a very good online archive in which you can also magnify handwritings, and sometimes it's very funny if we have a question concerning the text about the piece in different editions, we'll just hook on the internet and look into the score. It's
You're talking about his manuscript scores.
I'm talking about the manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Many of the quartets are in Bonn, and since we know the house very well, we can often go there and just look at them. And I personally find that also, again, emotionally, so exciting to look at Beethoven's handwriting, because if you always see a printed score, everything looks so neat. But other than, for example, Bach or Mozart, who wrote in a very accurate way their handwriting, the handwriting of Beethoven is visibly tormented by his emotion and by his drive. I don't even know how to say that in English, but he writes in a way that you can hardly read it, and some of the sforzatos or some of the things he writes are so violently put onto paper that he nearly rips the paper, and sometimes he crosses out notes and writes others on top. He crosses them out again, writes third ones on top, so that in the end you cannot read anything anymore, and then he just writes the name of the note beside the note. So it's really interesting to see that dialectics of super emotional composition, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, of course, his great idea of the form and of the general expression, which he's totally sure about. He doesn't revise a whole form. He just smashes down his notes in a super emotional way, and for us that is fantastic to see, and I think that puts these pieces so much into a present understanding.
Well, it's certainly true of Beethoven's quartets that they do sound a lot more modern than you would think they would given when he wrote them.
Exactly.
And I want to refer also here to another quote, again from the same Telegraph article, also still talking about Piazzolla, but it seems to me it applies here, or I imagine it applies here. They're quoting you, actually, where you say there's a cliche that a string quartet should sound polite and peaceful, but we always try to keep the rough edges in. What does that mean in relation to Beethoven, and maybe particularly in relation to what you just said about some of the passion that he gave into actually writing this music?
Well, I think that applies totally to Beethoven, because we always tend to think that music that in our time is established always was established. But we like to think of it in a way that every music which was written, including Beethoven, including Schubert, or even Mozart, was modern music at that time, that had a certain edge to it, which people could not understand, which was provoking, which was not at all established. So it's, I think it's very helpful to look at it that way in order also to put it into a context of our time. I feel that many people are becoming a little alienated by classical music because they have the feeling this is something from a museum that has nothing to do with our time, and we feel that we want to present music, classical music, for a public of our time by the emotional directness and maybe also by the provocative edge and the courage of doing something new and discovering new territory, which always is a fascinating thing in human culture. So I think Beethoven, probably being one of the most daring composers in relation to his time, can transmit this intention in a very powerful way. So I think we have a special affinity to this music because the whole conception of playing fits so well to Beethoven.
We heard the final movement from Beethoven's String Quartet Opus 59, number 2, his E minor quartet called the Razumovsky, performed by the Artemis Quartet, who will be performing an all-Beethoven concert at the Krannert Center in Urbana tonight at 7:30, and we were pleased to have their cellist, Eckhart Runge, on the show with us for the first portion of Live and Local coming up in just a moment. Folk singer Bill Staines, who will be in Urbana on Saturday night. Our program today on FM 90.9 has been made possible with support from the Danville Symphony Orchestra. Jeremy Swirling and Margaret Jones perform the classics this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. in the Danville High School Auditorium. More information is available from the Symphony Office at 443-5300. And I should mention that violinist Margaret Jones, who is concertmaster of the Danville Symphony, will be on our show on Friday, playing a little bit live and also playing some from a recorded recital of hers. So we'll look forward to that. On this portion of Live and Local on FM 90.9, my guest is Bill Staines, who is going to be at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center this Saturday, giving a concert at 8 o'clock. That's in the old post office building in Urbana. And he is on the phone with me in somewhere. Where are you right now?
I'm actually just outside of Columbus, Ohio, Kevin.
And the reason I put it quite that way is that I understand you drive and drive and drive.
I drive about 70,000 miles a year, performing all over the country. And I fly some more, but generally when I'm on the road, I'm playing almost every night, and so it just makes sense to drive.
And what appeals to you about going to so many places and driving so many miles? There must be something just about the travel.
Well, you know, it's what I do for a living, first of all, I love playing music for people, and so in order to get the music out to people, you have to travel. So, I mean, you have to go on tour. So I look forward to it. Every day is sort of a new adventure. I never know what's going to happen, but I have these things called little victories, you know, and you meet somebody or somebody invites you to go dog sledding or so many things like that. You go a different place or experience something new, and so that's always important. So it keeps it alive.
Well, you could certainly do what probably most artists do and sing not anywhere near the number of concerts a year. What are you, 200 plus or something like that every year?
It's about 175, 180 nowadays. Yeah,
that's a lot of singing. How do you maintain your voice over the years? Have you noticed what kind of changes have you noticed in your singing quality and style?
Well, you know, I'm pretty much doing the same style that I did, you know, have done all along. I mean, I was influenced by, you know, a lot of people like very early Gordon Lightfoot, Ian and Sully, and so my style has pretty much remained the same. You know, when people ask me, you know, how can you sing for like 20 nights in a row? And you know, I always figured my voice is a lot like a car. I mean, it likes to be out on the highway. It likes to be working. And if you're singing on a Friday or Saturday or something like that, and then you don't sing again for 5 or 6 days, that's really hard on your voice. But if you're singing all the time, and if you take care of yourself, then it's actually easier, I think, on your voice to keep singing night after night than it is singing Friday and Saturday. By Saturday, your voice is just about warmed up, and then you have 4 or 5 days off. So, or maybe, you know, you sing every other night or something like that. And so your voice doesn't get to loosen up and stay loosened. And so I think, you know, I think singing night after night actually is probably healthier for it.
I was talking just the other day on this show with a few singers of early classical music and talking about how men and women know at different ages what kind of voice they're going to have. And of course, as people get older from their 20s on, the voice has changed a little bit. And it sounds to me from the sampling I've done of some of your work that your voice has deepened and gotten even richer than it started out to be. I just loved listening to your most recent disc, which is, I'm blanking on the name, Old Men or something like that. What do you call it?
Old Dogs.
Old Dogs.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, my voice has gotten huskier, and, you know, and I just, you know, I don't know, I guess I've always had a good ear for music, so it's you know, I've always been surrounded by music, so it's been fairly easy for me to sing. When I go into the studio, pretty much everything we do as far as vocals go is either close to being a first take as anything, really. I just sort of go in there and sing the songs, and I say, you know, if you hear a bad note, then we'll stop and do it over again or whatever, but you know, and usually sing through it and they go, that was fine. So I've been fortunate that way.
And you in your travels, I imagine you sing in all kinds of different venues, small to large, middle size.
I do. You know, it's, I mean, I've done house concerts in the middle of the week in people's living rooms, and I've done large concerts in, you know, Denver, Seattle, and Minneapolis, actually, the noon whistle is going off here.
Yeah, I hear that.
And so it's, you know, I mean, I play for anybody who'll listen, really.
And that's you've done that since the beginning, starting off in New England, Boston area. I see a listing in your biography. You just say colleges, concerts, clubs, coffee houses, pretty much everywhere. I don't know. Maybe this is just a misconception on my part, but for some reason, I don't think of folk singers coming out of New England, but is that just really... I always think of folk singers as sort of being heartland of the country for some reason or another.
Well, actually, in the 60s, you know, when the quote folk scare was happening, there were some major music scenes. Sorry about the siren. There were some major music scenes, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, New York, of course, Greenwich Village, and Chicago. And so I was part of the Boston Cambridge folks, and that's where Joan Baez came from. And so there were a lot of the Unicorn Coffee House, and to this day, and the Club 47, which was where she started singing, and people like Tom Rush and Dick and Mimi Farina, let's see, who else, Taj Mahal. These were all people that were living in the Boston area. You know, when you think about people like Dave Van Ronk and Phil Oakes, and that they were people from the New York scene, but there were a lot of people that came out of the Boston scene. And to this day, actually, New England is a hotbed of folk and traditional music, probably more than any other place. I think about 5 years ago, somebody did a census of folk venues, and within a 25-mile radius of Boston, there were 67 of them. So it's still a major music center, a folk music center.
Well, I had a feeling that my question came more out of ignorance than anything else of just where everybody comes from, because I'm not always very aware of that.
Sure.
I want to give our listeners a sample of your singing. We have a disc here called Going to the West, which I thought maybe we'd play that, the title track, just because it sort of suggests some of your travels. And of course, I guess you're heading west right now. From Columbus, you'll end up out here before too long.
That's right.
Anything you'd like to say about the song? What was the inspiration behind it?
Well, this is actually a traditional song, I believe it comes from Alabama. There are all kinds of versions of it. This is more sort of a bluegrass string band arrangement of it. There are some slow versions of it, but it's a traditional song from Alabama, and I guess it's sort of pretty self-explanatory. It's somebody leaving home to head out to the West in probably the Gold Rush times, or just to move out there to see what kind of adventure they could experience.
Well, let's give it a listen. Bill Staines, Going to the West, from his disc of the same name, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Traditional song called Going to the West, sung by Bill Staines here on Live and Local, and he's my guest on this portion of the show. He's going to be at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center in Urbana this Saturday evening at 8 o'clock, giving a concert. And as you said, that was a traditional song. Mostly you do your own songs, right?
I do mostly my own stuff, but my roots are in traditional music. At least when I started playing, I was listening to, you know, a lot of the ballads that Joan Baez was singing, and a lot of the songs out of the folk songs of North America, you know, that Alan Lomax or John Lomax collected, and that's what people were doing at the time. I mean, even if you listen to the Kingston Trio, a lot of it was traditional music, traditional ballads that had a sort of a modern, a contemporary arrangement to them. But so I've always loved traditional music and the traditional melodies, and I think a lot of the folk melodies, the beautiful folk melodies have been around so long because, you know, they're beautiful. And I think you find almost a lot of the traditional melodies is a foundation for the melodies that I write.
You refer to melody specifically. Are there other criteria that get you interested in covering a particular traditional song or maybe a song by somebody else?
Well, you know, melody is the thing that attracts me to the song first. I think obviously there are melodies and lyrics to a song, if the melody is compelling and the lyrics are compelling for any song, that enables that song to stay around for a long time. People want to hear the song over and over. If it has something to say, you know, if there's something of value in the song, then that enables that song to stay around for a long time. I try, in my own writing, to be as universal as possible with the melodies make the melodies accessible, you know, singable. I do a lot of songs with choruses in them, and then I try and bring something of value to people through my music. There are sort of people, you know, I don't want to necessarily get up every day and write a song about my coffee cup or something like that. It's like, you know, because nobody really cares about my coffee cup. But now and again, something will come along and tap me on the shoulder, and I said, you know, I need to share this experience with people, or I've learned something that's important out of this experience, and I need to share that with people. And that's where the songs generally come from.
I have your disc here called The First Million Miles, referring to the amount that you do drive. Any of those songs on there that might be particularly illustrative of what you're just talking about, of something that really might have special meaning to, might bring something to the listener especially?
I'm trying to think what's on that album. Let's try Down the Road. I mean, that's a real positive song, and I think that would illustrate it a little bit.
Okay, Down the Road of Bill Staines, who's also the performer here on Live and Local.
I do believe there will be waiting for me somewhere down the road. Down the road, if the way seems long and slow, remember when you go, there's a day worth living down the road.
A song called Down the Road by Bill Staines, performed by the same man, from his disc, which is a compilation, is called The First Million Miles. And he's here with us on Live and Local on the telephone from just outside Columbus, Ohio, I think you said. And
right.
He's going to be performing at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. You can hear him live and local in our listening area Saturday night at 8 o'clock. When you're writing your own songs, I know that a lot of them get picked up by other people and have shown up in various places, including films and so on. Do you give any thought at all to having someone else sing the song besides yourself? I know you said that you try to make the melodies universally accessible.
Well, as far as other people recording my songs, you know, I always think, you know, sometimes people will say, or an artist will say, well, I don't have any children, but my paintings are my children, or a choreographer would say my dances are my children. But when it comes to songwriting, you know, it really makes sense because, like, you, the song enters the world, the song is born, and you need to nurture the song because nobody knows it. If you don't sing it yourself, then it basically dies. It doesn't go anywhere. If it's a healthy song, if it's a good song, then it begins to grow, and then it eventually begins to develop relationships with other people the same way a child would. And then much farther on down the line, it's grown, it's become involved in all these different relationships, and eventually those relationships don't have anything to do with you anymore. It's like, you know, it's like your son or daughter grows up and discovers a cure for some disease or something like that, and well, you're proud of the child, but it's out there doing whatever it's going to do, and that really doesn't have anything to do with you anymore. It develops a life of its own. And so when people record my songs, I'm glad that they like the song. I'm glad that they're, you know, but everybody has their own interpretation of it, whether it be in an arrangement or whether it be the tempo or what it means to them personally. And that really doesn't have anything to do with me. And so somebody will ask me, what do you think of this artist's recording of your song? And it's like, well, that's their version of it, you know, so long as the guitar is in tune, I guess, or something like that. But and only once or twice has an artist, sort of changed the words where it's not quite what the meaning of the song was, sort of compromised. But generally speaking, of all the people that recorded the songs, it's just, there are all kinds of versions of the Roseville Fair, you know, but... you know, it really, you know, I have my version of it. Liam Clancy has his version of it, which is wonderful. And so that really, you know, that really doesn't have anything to do with me anymore. So I just sort of sit back and enjoy it.
Since you mentioned the song, I wonder if that wouldn't be a good one for our listeners to hear right now.
Let's do it.
That's from also collected on The First Million Miles. What was that? Which album was that originally from?
It was originally from an album called The Whistle of the Jay.
The Whistle of the Jay. And I'm just amazed that you can just pull these off the top of your head. We've got, what, some 26 albums or so by now?
Yeah. Well, I know the albums. You know, I've lived with them for many years.
And, of course, lived with all the songs and wrote them. Roseville Fair, sung and written by Bill Staines here on Live and Local.
Thank you.
Roseville Fair was the name of the song here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly with the singer and songwriter, Bill Staines, who is going to be at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center Saturday night at 8 o'clock. I love the analogy you made just before we played that of songs to children or offspring. And do I understand right that you have a son who is also a folk singer?
My son, Bowen, well, he's a wonderful musician. Actually, he graduated from Savannah College of Art and Film and Television. So he's been working on documentaries now for National Geographic and has his own little film company. So he's a wonderful musician, and he marries the music, but I think his real passion is film.
And does he suggest that you've got some influence on him other than the obvious fact that you sing and he sings?
Well, you know, I think for any person, any child that's growing up in a family that's musical, where there's music being played all the time, it's hard to not be influenced by that musical experience. You know, I don't know if I've had any influence in style, as far as style on performance, but he certainly has, you know, been surrounded by music his whole life, so I'm sure in that way it's an influence.
Do you have more than the one child?
No.
A lot of your songs have shown up in grade school books and so on. Do you feel a particular affinity to either writing for children or songs that seem to be particularly appropriate for them?
Well, you know, not really. Once again, it's A Place in the Choir has a life of its own. I mean, it's sung in church choirs and, you know, in grade schools and, you know, it's just come out as an illustrated children's book. And, you know, once again, it's just that, you know, when I wrote it, it was almost like a doodle, you know, and I wasn't sure I even liked the song. And then many, many years later, it's sort of become a, you know, I guess a folk classic. You know, I don't write specifically for children or anything like that, but occasionally a song will come out that the children love. I mean, I'm amazed at sometimes, you know, a 10-year-old child or you know, will come up to me and say, I really like the song The Last Mine of the Chisas, which is about this lost mine in the middle of the desert in Texas. And it's like, why would this child be interested in this song? You know, or it's just, you just never know. I mean, I've done albums of, I don't even really call them children's albums. I call them more like a family album. The Happy Wanderer and One More River were two albums I did for Red House. You know, there are songs like Home on the Range and Kookaburra and a lot of traditional stuff, plus some songs that I've written. There's one called Four Little Sailors, which is all about the joy of reading, if you will, and how important it is. And so, you know, I've written some songs that children seem to be attracted to.
I guess I'll find out on Saturday night, but when you're doing your shows... Now, do you like to go back through the whole catalog of your own songwriting history, or do you tend to focus on the more recent ones? And by any chance, is that why you keep writing songs, so you've got more new stuff to sing?
Well, you know, my shows sort of evolve. I mean, there are songs that I wrote 30 years ago, over 30 years ago, that I still do. And I love doing them. You know, the Roseville Fair, for instance, was written back in 1977. Song River, which I close every show with, was written back in 76, I believe, 75 or 76. And then, you know, and then I do, as I write a song, you know, I do the more recent songs also, and everything in between. I've been writing a lot on the keyboards lately, and that's not... I'm not somebody you would hire to play keyboards. And so some of the songs I write on the keyboards travel to the guitar so that I do them in concert, and some of them get recorded, and I don't do them in concert even though I may like the song. So I tell some stories, and I always love to have people sing along on the choruses because I grew up in the 60s, and that's what everybody did, and that's what I still enjoy doing. So it's pretty much a straight across the board thing.
Just one more question before we let you go and before we play one more song of yours, and that's particularly for the people who are going to come to the show on Saturday, because they'll see something immediately that might strike them as different, and that's the way you hold your guitar.
Well, I play the guitar upside down. It's basically, it's a right-handed guitar, but I'm playing it as if it were left-handed. So I just, when I was about 11 years old, somebody handed me a guitar, and I knew I was left-handed, so I figured, well, I could tell the right-handed way, and I just flipped it over and said, well, that must be the left-handed way of playing it, and put my fingers where the dots were in the chord book, and then it was 40 years later. So it's not something you see every day, but it's not something you see every day, but it's something that, that's not all that rare. I mean, Jimi Hendrix played upside down, Elizabeth Cotton, Albert King plays upside down. So it's always the same story, which is like, well, it was basically youthful ignorance, and I never took any guitar lessons.
And, well, there are left-handed guitars, I guess.
Yes, there are.
But
yeah.
I don't think people use those any. It seems like it's about equally. Either use a left-handed guitar, or they do what you're doing, or they just stay left-handed but do it the right-handed way.
Right.
Of course, the irony is, being left-handed, a right-hander fingers with his left hand. But I guess is the feeling more in what you do with your right hand, with your dominant hand, is in the plucking.
Well, you know what I think it is more than anything? Because, you know, when you're playing the keyboard, you have both hands out in front of you. So is there a dominant hand? I mean, there's no way of playing the keyboards upside down. So I think what it is more than anything is it's actually the physical makeup of the instrument. It's like, you know, if you were left-handed and you wanted to, use a bow and arrow, for instance, you would want to extend your right arm with the bow and pull back with your left arm. And I think the guitar is the same way. The guitar is essentially, forgive the analogy, but it's sort of like a rifle. I mean, you want to extend your right hand. And so I think that's what it is more than one dominant hand over another. It's not that one likes to pick and one likes to fret. I think it's really just the physical makeup of the instrument.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time for joining us here on the program today. I might as well mention that if folks want to have some of your songs of their own, not only just recorded, but also written down, you've got a number of songbooks.
There's one songbook available that's published by Hal Leonard Corporation. There was another one before that that's out of print, but I think someday I'll get it all together to put all the songs in one book. But there is at least one that's published by Hal Leonard.
And what's that one called?
It's called Music to Me, The Songs of Bill Staines. And there are about 30 or 35 songs in that book.
And for more information on Bill Staines, you can go to his website, which is acousticmusic.com. And is it /Staines or?
Yeah, it is /Staines. Or you can just go to Google and type in Bill Staines.
That's how I found it. Bill Staines will be at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana in the old post office building Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And I encourage you to go out and hear him live. And we're very pleased to have had you on the show today. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.
We are crossing the water. Our whole life through, we are making a passage that is straight and true. Every heart is a vessel, every dream is a light shining through the darkness of the blackest night. Oh, we are crossing the water our whole life through. We are making a passage that is straight and true. Every heart is a vessel.